copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Well, welcome everybody. I'm going to start promptly and just thank you for coming. I'm speaking about smart design, and thank you for coming tonight. It's actually the design and irreducible complexity. So just let me do that again. The title that you have is Design and Irreducible Complexity. In order to understand this concept, I've actually added the phrase smart design, because then I think it shows what we're really getting at here. I will define what irreducible complexity is, but I'm going to use some illustrations to show this to you. You'll be sad to know that the Bombardier Beetle, which I spoke on last year, is not included because I've already spoken on it, but that could be also an interesting example. But what is irreducible complexity? Well, it basically is when a system has interdependent components which all need to operate together in order for there to be any progress. Nothing works unless everything works is a fairly good summary. They've got to work in harmony together. And so one illustration of this in man-made systems where things went wrong is the famous Boeing 737 MAX, which you probably know went wrong in 2019. Two major accidents occurred, because what had happened is that the sensor was not communicating correctly to the aircraft controls and was insisting on that the aircraft was too high and therefore going into a stall in the thinking of the automatic system, when in fact it wasn't going into a stall and the aircraft was simply taking off. So there was an incorrect information of the angle of attack sensor which caused this. So interacting systems always need correct control. Now, there was a control system, but now they've had to revise that control system, and basically Boeing had to admit that it was in fact a design fault. But what this shows is that when you've got a system which is connected to other systems, you've got to have them working in harmony, not against each other, which is what of course happened in this accident. So a smartphone, like your iPhone or whatever, Samsung phone or whatever it is you've got, is an illustration of this. Interconnected systems, interdependent with one another. So if you want to use the camera on the phone, then you've got to have some hardware and some software which is controlling that. For instance, you might also have a system where with a camera, that is, and most iPhones have this and most smartphones have this, where you might want to expand it so that you zoom in on an image, or you might want to have the other camera looking towards you to take a selfie. So a smartphone also illustrates layered systems. You've got macro, so you've got the phone itself, you've got micro, you've got the tiny interconnected circuits inside. And when it comes to nature, although we haven't yet got molecular systems in our phones, although that could come, certainly in nature you have molecular systems. So that means you've got layered systems. So unless the molecular system is working, then the micro system is not going to work and the macro won't work. So you really do this is a different point to interconnected systems, which could be at the same level. Then you've got a third point, which is one which I've already implied. If you're taking a picture, then you're using an app where you are invited to actually use your mind to decide what you want to do next. Or if you're using the GPS on the phone, you press a particular app. So the app there is available and is waiting for you to interact with an input from outside. So if we're thinking of natural systems, this would be an input from the environment, which is triggering something. So you've got sensing. Whoops, sorry, that was going the wrong way. You've got sensing, you've got actuation, and you've got control. And this is typical of smart design, where it isn't just doing one thing, it's waiting for other triggering inputs to actually cause that machine, whatever's been invented, but in man-made systems, to do something different to what it was doing perhaps earlier. So this is very true of a lot of smart systems we have today. You have a smart system to control your central heating at home, or whatever it is that is digitally controlled today. We're going to look at five examples of smart design. Sorry, I've gone wrong again. Sorry. Let me just get this picture up. Five examples I'm going to look at. We're going to look at flight control in birds. We're going to look at flight control in dragonflies and the metamorphosis of them. You'll see that in the summary of the notes that are available on the app for this session. And by the way, the slides are also available in a PDF format, not quite the same high quality, slightly lower quality in order to get them not to go on the app. Then we're going to look at molecular motors. And amazingly, I don't know whether you're aware of this, but there are intermeshing gears in nature. And if I get time, I'll get to the ordinary leaf, although I may not get time for that. So I'm going to look first of all at flight control in birds. So we're just looking at birds initially. In birds, they have, of course, wings made of feathers, but their control system is something which inspired the Wright brothers, who were the first ones to actually build a man-made aircraft which flew with engines and was powered. This is a white-tailed eagle, which you can see in these pictures, which is showing the aerodynamics which is being formed and controlled by the bird changing its wing shape and changing the way that its wings are set in order to go into a turn. There is lift coming on those aerofoil shapes, which of course are made of feathers on a bird. And a bird cannot fly without a tail, which actually balances the flight in a longitudinal way. Now, this was understood by the Wright brothers. They actually put their tail, by the way, at the front. But you do need an extra surface, not just two wings, but you need an extra surface. You usually put it today at the back, but they decided to put theirs at the front. It didn't really matter that they did that, but they also warped the wings, which is what birds do. And wings are made with a special shape in order to cause the airflow to be turned. And as soon as you turn the flow, you get lift. And the feathers have to be put in the right location. So all these things have got to be right for a bird. So this is illustrating the irreducible nature of wings on birds. You can't just have primary feathers only. You need to build up the shape going, looking down in a planform way. So we're looking from the root on the left where the tertiary feathers are, through to the secondary, through to the primaries, which are right at the extreme right. Then as you come from the back to the front, you're building the wing up with what we call covering feathers or covert feathers. And then you need the retroces feathers, which are at the tail. And there are other feathers as well, which I haven't time to go into in depth in this particular talk. I just want to illustrate this principle of irreducible complexity. So if you look sideways on at the wing, you'll see that the wing, of course, for a bird is made of feathers. And just to get this point over, you've got to have thicker feathers building covering feathers, covert feathers at the front, and thinner at the back. So one is making an aerofoil shape using feathers, which themselves are actually individually all different. And indeed, those feathers are themselves irreducibly complex in their own right, because a feather, when you put it under a microscope, has the rachis, which is the main stem going from the base to the tip. But coming from the rachis, which is the main stem, you've got barbs, right, which is the thick line in the diagram below the pigeon's secondary feather that I've put there. And coming from the barb, and it's only visible under the microscope, are barbules, note, barbules, mini barbs, which have hooks on going vertically on my diagram, and horizontally, the barbules have ridges on. So the hooked barbules slide over the ridged barbules. Well, this is absolutely essential for what we call a pernicious feather, that is a feather which is carrying the air and is not just there for warmth. We call the other feathers downy feathers, but most of the feathers on the wing are pernicious feathers. They're used for flying. Then it is essential to have this interlocking system. You can't have half an interlocking system. You can't say, well, we'll wait for a bit longer for a further mutations to occur according to the evolutionary hypothesis for barbules with ridges to appear in order for the hooks to work. The hooks are of no use unless you've got the other system coming across horizontally, which has got ridges on. This is an actual photograph of the hooks coming from the right, in this case, the hooked barbules sliding over the ridged barbules, which are coming from the bottom to the top. So this illustrates that a feather in its own right holds the principle of irreducible complexity. Nothing will work unless both systems are there, the right-handed and the left-handed barbules. But of course, that is true in a larger macro state, that every feather has to be in the right place. You've got to have retroces, which is the tail feathers. You've got to have the thickening of the wing in order to get the aerofoil shape. Not that I accept personally my position. I'm not going to argue on this here. But for the sake of argument, I've just put what people think is the age of this amber fossil, which was found, which had got some feathers in it. I don't particularly agree with that age for other reasons, but that's not the argument here. I want you to see that the amber holds the system, which is exactly the same in principle as to what we have today. So flight needs control. And you need flaps at the back of the wings. This is illustrated on an Airbus A310. And you can see that the flaps are basically doing what the Wright brothers did, except that instead of warping the wing, you actually add another surface at the back. We'll come to the forward ones in a moment. And if you don't get this right, then it can be problematic. Unfortunately, that poor fellow managed to get the aircraft down. But
an adult wanderer may travel 5,000 miles, sometimes to Brazil and back, in order to collect squid for its young.
But the natural equivalent of what you've just seen in the man-made Boeing 737 with the albatross shows far more control as the albatross comes into land after 3,000 miles, maybe out on the ocean getting food. So man-made machines have a narrow region of control, which that pilot almost crashed that Boeing 737. But for man-made creatures, for natural creatures, they have a wide range of control. The albatross can maneuver itself much more readily than man-made machines. That's really what that is showing. And control is part of irreducible complexity. And we've shown that these white-tailed eagles have all sorts of other surfaces. They have winglets at the end, and those winglets actually inspired the winglets that are used on Boeing 777s, used on Airbus A320s today, and many other aircraft. So curved winglets are actually essential for reducing induced drag. Now, these are things which are extras, but they are not compromising the basic irreducible complexity of the control of the main wings. In that sense, you could say they're not essential, but this is the point. Sometimes people add things to man-made machines and then get it wrong, illustrated by the 737 MAX that I mentioned earlier. Whereas in nature, you see that there is actually the capacity for having extras, which some creatures have, like this owl, which does not compromise the basic stability of the wing. One other little point here, but it's not unimportant. At low speed, you want to avoid a stall, and aircraft have what's called forward flaps or slats. Birds have the alula feather, which every bird actually has them, which enables there to be a forward forward flap, as it were, where the air is encouraged to come above the surface of the wing in order to re-energize what we call the boundary layer at low speed. They even also have what's called eddy flaps, which is basically stopping the stall, which will always develop on the top of a wing at low speed for a bird, and it stops it going forward. If you lift the feathers, this is done passively by the air itself, then this will stop the stall from actually going right across the wing and the bird falling out of the sky. So it's basically an automatic anti-stall flap. Well, these are all working together: feathers, wings, a tail, camber, which I mentioned that a bird changes automatically, the winglets, the alula feathers, the eddy flaps that I just mentioned. I could have talked to you about the breathing mechanism of birds, which actually feeds into the lightness of the body. I haven't time to go into that, but there is irreducible complexity here. If the bird didn't have all these things together, then it wouldn't be able to work. Certainly the first four, feathers, wings in the right place, the tail in the right place, the ability to change the camber. And indeed, you do actually need the alula feathers for low speed flight. You could just do without winglets, but you've got to have the breathing right, which is another story. There is irreducible complexity then, I'm arguing, in birds. Let me move on to dragonflies. Dragonflies also show an incredible irreducible complexity in their flight. Flight is something that I've studied for over 30, 35 years. I've been involved in aerodynamics, involved in heat transfer, involved in engineering. So this is right up my street, as it were, because I was involved in man-made aerodynamics, obviously for aircraft, for many years, and then I moved into combustion. We're not dealing with combustion this day, but we are dealing with the airflow over wings. Let's just have a little closer look at this Scarlet Marshhawk dragonfly. You'll notice that the dragonfly has very delicate wings, but please note that on the four wings, right at the end of the leading edge, there are four little black spots. I'm going to just speak briefly about them. These are called pterostigma, and they are essential for flight with light wings. The reason is that if you actually start flying with a very, very light wing, so if I illustrate it by this, if I don't know if you can see my image as well as what's on the screen, I'll try and do this in front of my camera. But if you actually fly with a very light wing, right, then what tends to happen is that it flutters. And this is due to the airflow picking up vortices, or vortices are caused on both sides of the wing, and particularly at the trailing edge, and it tends to vibrate the wing. However, it is known that if you make the wing just slightly heavier, then it will stop the vibration, the uncontrolled vibration. We call it in aerodynamic circles, we call it flutter. So I'll use that term. So the dragonfly wants to fly at roughly between 20 and 25 miles an hour. That's pretty fast for an insect, and they do fly that sort of speed. Well, if it was to fly that speed without these weights, the wing would flutter. But with the weight on there, it doesn't flutter. So it's an illustration of irreducible complexity. There would be no use for this insect to have supposedly evolved from some other creature if it didn't have the weights in the right place. And indeed, dragonflies have a power stroke in both directions, which is why they're much more powerful flyers than others. But I wanted you to see that those pterostigma is an illustration of this important issue of irreducible complexity. These wings have muscles to pull them down, but they also have muscles to pull each individual wing up. So they have eight muscles for their wings. And the way the dragonfly flies so fast is by maneuvering the flight of both of those wings, twisting the wings. We call that supination and pronation, pulling it down. And this is how the dragonfly is able to fly so fast and really is the master of insect flight. There is a lot of work being done on the way the wings are controlled. Remember that there is a separate muscle for pulling the wing down, the separate muscle for pulling the wing up. There is eight muscles to enable the twisting of the wing. And what you're seeing here in the red is the force on the wing, and the black represents the position of the wing. So we're looking end on at this diagram. And many years ago, in 1999, there was a wonderful bit of work done showing the twisting of dragonfly wings. Other insects will do this as well, but they are the masters as to increasing their lift. Let me just mention one other irreducibly complex part of dragonflies, and that is that they don't start as dragonflies. They start off as eggs laid in water. This is a picture which is shown in Life in the Undergrowth in the video, which I'm not going to show here, which shows to you a nymph coming out of the water where it has had gills and it has been breathing oxygen from the water. Now it is actually pulling out threads from holes in its thorax through which it will breathe, as well as breathing through its mouth. So it's now breathing in air when in beforehand it was breathing in water. How this came about by some sort of gradual evolutionary process is actually never explained, because this is an illustration of irreducible complexity. This is where something is actually starting in water and finishing its life in air. And indeed, the dragonfly never goes back into the water, and yet it lays its eggs for the propagation of the next generation on water for nymphs to develop in the water, which will again eventually come out of the water. So this very principle of metamorphosis is itself irreducibly complex, because the whole thing cannot emerge gradually. You cannot go from some sort of worm-like creature, if one's going to go to metamorphosis, even on the land, where you go from a caterpillar to a butterfly, where you're not involving water initially. But you can't gradually get this change from a creature which just has one body shape to two body shapes. You're actually needing both body shapes, both parts, if you like, of the life cycle in order to propagate the creature. So that itself is an illustration of irreducible complexity. And the holes which go into the body are called spiracles, which is why I've put there for that last point, you're breathing in through gills, going to breathing in with spiracles, the holes. So this is an illustration, again, where everything has to be right in order for this creature to propagate and to keep going, basically. So I would maintain that this principle of irreducible complexity, where nothing will work unless everything is working in harmony together, is actually illustrated time and again in all these creatures. Let's look at a third example, which is molecular motors in the cell. You may not be aware, but there are some remarkable findings in recent days of the ATP synthase motor, which is not my expertise, so I'm not going to comment on it in depth, but we know that it is an electrostatic motor. But the point I wanted to come to was, and in its own right, therefore, I think it's got principles of irreducible complexity in it. That's not my point, though, that I want to come to. I want to come to another molecular motor, which involves motion, where there is a thermodynamic principle going on. You obviously know that locomotion involves generally wheels of some kinds, or else walking. I won't play this, but you may be aware of the famous film produced by Nick Park, Wallace and Gromit, where there is a train chase and where Gromit actually lays down the railway as he's moving along. And of course, this can never happen in reality. Well, it's not quite that, but there is something very similar going on when the kinesin, which is the one I wanted to come to, walks along tubes, which are made not by itself, but by other proteins making the microtubules, which are the rails that it walks along. Just see this film with me, please, for a few moments.
Meet the kinesin. Masterpieces of microengineering, kinesins are miniature motorized machines that carry cargo from one part of the cell to another, walking along self-assembling highways called microtubules. Known as the workhorses of the cell, kinesins have 2 feet, or globular heads, that literally walk 1 foot over another along the microtubule, pulling their cargo to its destination. Each foot possesses 2 special locations, called binding sites, that interact with other molecules. One site attaches to the microtubule and the other binds with ATP, the energy molecule of the cell. When one foot binds with ATP and uses its energy, the foot flips over, resulting in the walking motion. Each foot has a short neck, which is connected to a strand of a long coiled stalk. At the end of the stalk is a fan-shaped tail, which holds tightly to the cargo being transported.
Now, that is fantastic to watch, but let's just examine what's going on. I'm not an expert on molecular machines, but I do know a thing or two about thermodynamics. What you've got here, as I understand when I talk to those who are the experts at the chemistry, is that you have 2 feet that was mentioned in that film, and you'll see that adenosine diphosphate is represented by D in this picture. Adenosine triphosphate, which has got extra energy, is represented by T in this picture. And of course, then as you examine this, it is actually converted into rotationary motion initially when the diphosphate the triphosphate is initially made where the one foot binds with the beta microtubule of the road which is being made. That becomes a triphosphate. So now we'll look at the second phase. And when it does that, it causes a rotation. I've read round this and nobody is actually entirely sure how the energy is transferred into a mechanical rotationary motion, but it does do this. Immediately the triphosphate is made, or in the process of making it, it actually causes a twisting motion. So the diphosphate leg, right, is now coming down, and the diphosphate is actually going to be hydrolyzed, which is what now happens next, as you can see the middle diagram. So the diphosphate is hydrolyzed, and it then causes the third stage to take place, where it settles on a bridge across 2 beta microtubule parts of the railway as it basically is going ahead. Then the diphosphate lifts again, and we are actually in almost at the next stage where there will be now a change and a twisting motion repeated. So this is how the walking motion goes along. Now, this is thermodynamics. This is energy transfer. This is energy transfer from the very, very small charge, which is then actually made into a twisting and a walking motion. And that energy transfer is still not being fully understood, but it is nevertheless there, and it's going on in every single cell of our bodies. So the system only works when many things are working together, and it certainly needs control. So this is using ATP. I haven't time to go into the ATP, but adenosine triphosphate, which has got 3 phosphates on it, is actually used in the stringing of DNA, and it's absolutely essential for everything in the cell. It's the energy molecule, as was said in the film, of the cell. Now, it's an unstable molecule. It doesn't want to stay like that. It actually wants to give off its energy, but it must be given off in a very controlled way, which therefore, in this particular case of the walking kinesin, it's been done with ATP binding. So it's been controlled by the microtubule. The adenosine diphosphate released then makes the kinesin twist and walk. The microtubule rails are built by other proteins as the kinesin walks along them. And the thermodynamic stepping between the raised energy level ATP and the reduced energy level adenosine diphosphate has to work in sequence. And there is a connecting rope to the cargo of what the kinesin is carrying to another point in the cell. And on top of this, there is must be, but I haven't gone into it, a DNA control system. It's certainly an illustration of irreducible complexity. Now, James Tour, I think, will talk to us about the details of the biochemistry of these amazing machines. But even just looking at this as an engineer and a thermodynamicist, I can see this is an illustration of irreducible complexity. I'm just going to get to number four and not get to number five because I want to enable you to have a little bit of time to talk. But I want to now mention intermeshing gears. Now, I find this another illustration of something extraordinary. In Cambridge University in 2013, a gentleman by the name of David Burrows, with a research helper, actually realized that there was gears in jumping insects. And this is the plant hopper insect called Issus. And this Issus develops an incredible ability with its hind legs to jump at a great acceleration. And in order to do that, it has its the legs behind, part of the legs has gears on it to make the legs zip out together. Let the film show you this.
Is that a small plant-sucking bug evolved gears long, long ago and uses these gears to mechanically synchronize the very rapid jumping movements of its legs. This is the first demonstration of interacting gears being used by any animal. The jump is really very rapid indeed. It takes off at a velocity of about 5 meters per second. That's equivalent to about 12 miles per hour. And it accelerates in less than a millisecond. So it experiences enormous G-forces as it takes off, about 500 or even 700 G.
This, the paper, which if you want to look at it, is in Science, and it was back in 2013. And it actually shows very detailed pictures here of the teeth of the gears and the distance that has to be had between each of the teeth, because if that distance was too small, then the teeth would not intermesh. And if the teeth were too big, they still wouldn't intermesh. So do you see that there is an irreducibly complex system here where gears are being used, where the curvature of the part of what's called the trochanter must be the same on both sides, and the shape of the gears and their distance that I just mentioned must also be correct. This is surely an illustration of irreducible complexity. Everything has to be right in order for this system to work. If you thought that was amazing, there are also other examples of functioning motors with intermeshing rotors. You've heard of the bacterial flagellum, which Michael Behe has championed in his book, Darwin's Black Box. But years later, people discovered that there was other bacterium which actually had not just one rotor, but many rotors, so many flagella, in order to propel them. They actually found that there was a flagellum or a flagella which had seven tails rotating one way. And if you have seven tails rotating one way, then the tendency would be to spin the flagella. And so it wouldn't be working very efficiently because you'd be spinning the whole body. So in order to avoid that, they realized that there was in this flagellum, there was actually 24 other smaller rotors going in the opposite direction. The best example we have in man-made machinery is what we do with a helicopter. In order to avoid the helicopter rotating about itself, you imagine the rotors of a helicopter, right, going round. Well, obviously, that will tend to move the helicopter itself. So you have another rotor at the back to actually push against that motion. Well, this flagellum actually has 24 other rotors around the seven main rotors to stop the movement of the flagellum about itself. The best way to illustrate this is to actually show you a diagram, a working diagram. So you've got the yellow ones, which are the seven flagella, which are actually coming out of the bacterium. And then you've got 24 little green ones, which are going around in the other direction. I find that stunning. And it's an illustration, is it not, of irreducible complexity. Nothing's going to work with this system unless you've got the green ones operating as well as the yellow. So there are five examples. I won't go to the last one because I want to enable you to have some time for questions. I'm just going to actually put up what I consider to be a summary. That it says in Acts 17, verse 28, in him we live and move and have our being. Johann Kepler spoke of thinking God's thoughts after him. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3 talks about God upholding all things by the word of his power. Now, I don't mean, of course, that God is actually in these things. That would be pantheism. But that he has left the fingerprint and the mark of his brilliant design by having these systems which show a mind which has made them. The scripture says that all things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. And Romans 1 verse 20, which I put in the summary of the notes, says the invisible things of God from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. I think that whatever you look at today in the science, whether it be the aeronautics, which I love to look at in birds and insects, or whether it be in the biochemistry of the kinesin, or whether it be in the incredible flagella of the those particular bacteria that I was mentioning, they all show the mind which has put everything together such that everything is dependent on other systems. We have layered systems. Remember that I said this is part of irreducible complexity. We have smart design. And indeed, the whole subject of biomimetics, where you copy nature with a view to using it in engineering, is tacitly accepting that there is brilliant, smart design in nature already. Thank you.